Tune Review and Speaking to the Blind, celebrating 40 years of audio newspaper production. Welcome to this week's edition of the National Podcast, recorded at the Bishop Briggs Media Centre by our amazing volunteers. You can get in touch with us via Facebook, Twitter or Instagram using @TuneReview, that is @CUEANDREVIEW. You can also contact us directly by emailing information@tunereview.com. That is information@CUEANDREVIEW.com or by calling 0141 772 3976. That's 0141 772 3976.
This is from The National on Friday, the 7th of July, 2023, from the news section. Holyrood COVID-19 Recovery Committee to be wound up. This article is written by Steph Braun. Holyrood's COVID-19 Recovery Committee is to be wound up, as its convener praised the important role it has played since being formed. The committee was created in 2021 to monitor the response of the Scottish Government and Holyrood to the pandemic. MSPs on the panel met for the final time last week, with the committee due to officially wind up next week following a decision in Parliament. A legacy report published by the committee recommends the response to long COVID, the recovery of NHS dentistry and cancer services, and the fate of public transport continues to be scrutinised by other Holyrood committees. In a statement, convener Jim Fairley said, "Since the committee was established in 2021, it played an important role in monitoring and scrutinising the Scottish Government's response to the COVID-19 pandemic and tracking recovery in a range of policy areas. We've carried out several high-profile inquiries into the impact of the pandemic on Scotland's labour market, how future public health messaging campaigns could be improved, made recommendations on long COVID, and considered how Scotland's dental services are recovering. The committee and I are incredibly grateful for the many valuable contributions from the public and other stakeholders who engaged with us, all of which helped shape and inform our work, particularly throughout our long COVID inquiry. Although the work of the committee has now come to an end, this legacy report will be available for the Parliament's other committees to consider and take into account as Scotland continues its journey towards recovery from the pandemic." That article was written by Steph Braun. This is from The National on Friday, the 7th of July, 2023. From the news section. Scottish Rugby puts Ruth Davidson on board as non-executive director. This article is written by Stuart Ward. Former Scottish Conservative leader Ruth Davidson has been appointed to the board of Scottish Rugby. She will hold the role of non-executive director, with the body also announcing the appointment of businessman Mike Sutar to the same position. Scottish Rugby cited Baroness Davidson of London Links' experience running a consultancy business as a speaker on leadership and diversity and on voluntary and charitable boards. Davidson said, "As a lifelong Scotland fan, I am delighted to be joining the board of Scottish Rugby Limited, SRL. From our community clubs through to the international teams, we have so much to be proud of, and so much further potential to be fulfilled. We have to match that potential with ambition, and that means working collectively to ensure we are getting things right, from talent spotting to training, infrastructure to finance, safeguarding to leadership, to name but a few. I want to help grow the game in Scotland in any way I can, and ensure the hard work which underpins it is directed in the most effective way possible." Scottish Rugby said Davidson would bring a breadth of experience to the board. It added, "As an experienced non-executive director across the manufacturing and financial sectors, She has a particular interest in ensuring companies and organisations deliver their environmental, social and governance ESG commitments. Sutar is the non-executive director of the V&A Dundee Museum and is known for his appearances as an interviewer on the BBC's The Apprentice. The Dundonian began his career with DC Thompson before launching Shortlist Media in 2007. Scottish Rugby chief executive Mark Dodson said the appointments would deliver experience and credibility to the board. He said, "It is a further demonstration of the power of sport and progress Scottish Rugby is committed to making, that we can welcome appointments who will deliver the level of experience and credibility Ruth and Mike will bring to Scottish Rugby Limited Board. As a sport, we have significant opportunities as well as challenges ahead in the coming years, and their respective experience will be invaluable as we navigate through the sporting, financial and societal changes we will be facing." John McGuigan, who chairs SRL, said, "I am delighted Ruth and Mike have agreed to join the SRL board. They bring significant experience gained over many years in areas that will be critical as we continue to evolve the game in Scotland. Alongside their experience and absolute love for the game, Mike and Ruth share my commitment to deliver results through working in partnership with all parts of Scottish Rugby." That article was written by Stuart Ward. This is from The National on Friday the 7th of July 2023, from the Politics section. Scottish Government independence spending to be probed by UK officials. This article is written by Laura Pollock. The Scottish Government is set to be investigated by UK officials over concerns it has been spending public money on matters not within its remit. Officials in the Treasury and the Office of the Advocate General of Scotland will look into money spent on working on a Scottish independence, which, as a matter of the Constitution, is reserved to Westminster. Scottish Labour peer George Foulkes, who has been campaigning on the issue, said he had been assured by Keith Stewart, the Advocate General for Scotland, that ultra vires expenditure would be looked into. Ultra vires is Latin and means beyond the powers. It describes actions taken by government bodies or corporations that exceed the scope of power given to them by laws or corporate charters. Foulkes told the House of Lords, "The Advocate General for Scotland has agreed, at my request, to instruct his officials to investigate ultra vires expenditure by the Scottish Government." He then asked Treasury Minister Joanna Penn to give her assurance that her officials in the Treasury will work cooperatively with the Advocate General's officials. Penn responded, "I can give him that assurance." This comes after First Minister Humza Yousaf created a Minister for Independence role for Jamie Hepburn, with civil servants in Scotland contributing to work on papers for independence. Foulkes, a former Labour Scotland office minister, has previously claimed it is illegal for the SNP to spend UK taxpayers' money to plan for a second referendum and promote the case for independence. In July 2022, Conservatives in the House of Lords rejected his repeated pleas for the Scottish Government to be forbidden from spending money on a future referendum. The UK and Scottish Governments have been approached for comment. This article was written by Laura Pollock. This is from The National on Friday the 7th of July 2023, from the Politics section. Scottish Greens and campaigners slam Shell boss comments. This exclusive article is written by James Walker. The Scottish Greens have slammed oil and gas giants following dangerous comments from the boss of Shell. Chief Executive Wael Sowan told the BBC on Thursday that the world still desperately needs oil and gas. He added that the switch to renewable energy is not happening fast enough to replace it, and cautioned that it could lead to soaring energy bills. Scottish Greens MSP Maggie Chapman slammed fossil fuel industry giants in response, saying they should be funding the transition themselves. She said, "They have caused the damage and their actions have consequences. They should take their responsibility to the world they are destroying seriously." Climate campaigners also condemned the comments. Jamie Peters, head of climate at Friends of the Earth, said, "It's no surprise that a fossil fuel company like Shell wants to continue unabated extraction of oil and gas. Let's be clear, companies like Shell are fueling both the climate crisis and the soaring cost of energy. They are profiting from the misery of ordinary people while destroying the planet, and they're making a cynical case to continue locking us into the volatile fossil fuel markets that are the root cause of the energy crisis." Kate Norgrove, Executive Director of Campaigns at WWF, added that the comments were dangerous. She said, "Shell, using their platform to scare the world into thinking there is no alternative to fossil fuel, is dangerous. Continuing to extract oil and gas and ignoring science on alternatives will push our global temperatures to the point of no return. We know that without an end to fossil fuel extraction, we will not meet our net zero targets. These targets are there to halt and reverse the horrific damage we have inflicted on this planet, not to line the pockets of extractive industries, who continue to flourish while the world burns." Shell recently sparked widespread criticism after announcing a move to stop reducing the amount of oil it produces until 2030. Green campaigners slammed the group's move as utterly destructive after it dropped its plan to reduce oil production by between 1 to 2% each year of this decade. Shell declared victory, saying the target was actually reached 8 years early after it sold off oil fields to others who will extract that oil instead, with a controversial decision also coming as part of a plan to boost its share price. A spokesman for Shell added, "Shell has already reduced its liquids production by 21% since 2019, and once we hit the stable production level we recently outlined, it will have fallen by 26%. That represents a greater reduction than the initial 1 to 2% per year cuts we set out in 2021 would have achieved by 2030. Chapman, the MSP for North East Scotland, said the fossil fuel giants only care about profits. She added, "The oil and gas giants are responsible for the climate emergency. They have known for nearly 50 years that their industry is damaging our environment. They have knowingly brought us to the brink of climate breakdown. Our world is burning around us, but the fossil fuel giants and the politicians who support them don't care. They only care about their profits. Just this week, we've seen the hottest day on the planet. Ever. If we want a livable future on Earth, we cannot continue with new oil and gas exploration, and we must drastically cut our dependence on existing planet-wrecking fossil fuels. The transition to renewables must be intensified, and it must be a fair and just shift that embraces and supports the communities and workers who have relied on the oil and gas industry. And the fossil fuel industry giants themselves should be funding the transition. They have caused the damage and their actions have consequences. They should take their responsibility to the world they are destroying seriously. The just transition is vital in the northeast of Scotland, which I represent, but also in the communities around the world. Those communities, workers, and their skills should be right at the heart of building a fairer, greener future." And that article was written by James Walker. This is from The National, on Friday the 7th of July 2023, from the news section. Sean Connery Foundation Dyslexia Initiative yields positive results. This article is written by Laura Pollock. An education programme funded by the foundation set up in Sir Sean Connery's name is already helping children with dyslexia, a local authority has said. The Sean Connery Foundation paid for an educational initiative which provided specialist teachers and assistants in Edinburgh, Working in 15 primaries and 2 secondaries, they developed capacity of staff to help pupils with dyslexia or literary difficulties. This has resulted in 215 pupils benefiting from the extra support and the wider training programme reaching 175 teaching staff. A City of Edinburgh Council analysis of the work found children are flourishing since the launch of the initiative last August. The Edinburgh-born James Bond star was not dyslexic, but his family said learning to read was life-changing for him. The foundation set up by his family helps a number of programmes in Scotland and the Bahamas, both places he called home. His son, Stefan Connery, who is chairman of the foundation, said, "The single most important event in Sean's life was learning to read. It opened up his world." Sean was very conscious of the stigma that people with dyslexia endure. "It is terrible for their confidence, despite the fact that many dyslexic people are truly gifted with fresh, original perspectives. Our hope is that the Sean Connery Dyslexia Initiative helps to unlock this genius, helping students to grow in confidence and thrive in school." The Council's education convener, Joan Griffiths, said, "Thanks to this funding from the Sean Connery Foundation and our long-standing partnership with Dyslexia Scotland, we have been able to significantly increase support for learners who benefit most from this targeted work. Although we're still in the early stages of this groundbreaking project, the early results are really encouraging and building on the excellent work already taking place around literacy and dyslexia in our schools. The programme is due to continue for another 2 years." That article was written by Laura Pollack. This is from The National on Friday the 7th of July 2023, from the news section. SNP MSP Jim Fairley calls out M&S over imported stock. This article is written by Xander Eliards. An SNP MSP has raised concerns that Marks & Spencer is importing stock from abroad instead of looking to the world-class suppliers in Scotland. Jim Fairley, the founder of Scotland's first farmers' market, and who was elected to Holyrood in 2021, raised the issue with the supermarket chain after seeing that Scottish raspberries were not on offer. Instead, the MSP for Perthshire South and Kinrossshire said that Marks & Spencer's in his nearest city had been stocking fruit from Portugal and South England. He wrote on Twitter, "Extremely disappointed in this. Still no Scottish raspberries on your shelves in Perth, world-class right on your doorstep, despite a bumper crop, and you're bringing up from England and shipping from Portugal. Where is your commitment to our Scottish growers?" he added. Blairgowrie in Perthshire is known for its berry crops. The raspberries pictured in the MSP's post had been grown in Kent and Portugal. Marks & Spencer's said that raspberries from Scottish producers would be harvested and available soon. Fairley also shared a comment from another Twitter user who said that, credit where credit's due, other supermarkets had been stocking Scottish produce. Fiona Carmichael wrote, "Got a nice surprise from Tesco today. Raspberries, strawberries, both and free-range eggs, all from Scotland, all with sole tyres. Credit where credit's due. Sainsbury's, Morrison's, over to you," she added. In January, a poll conducted for The National found that 71% of Scots said they preferred to see a saltire on Scottish produce rather than a union flag. At the time, the founder of Keep Scotland the Brand, Ruth Watson, wrote, "Many in the business of selling Scottish produce know it is not a question of flags on food, but market share based on Scotland's name, with its deserved reputation for high standards." A Marks & Spencer spokesperson said, "We work with many Scottish farms, sourcing raspberries, strawberries, blueberries, blackberries and cherries. Our Scottish raspberries will start being harvested this month, and will be available in all 94 Scottish stores this summer. That article was written by Xander Eliards.
From the National, Monday the 10th of July 2023, from the news section, NHS Health Board fined after Paisley patient takes own life. Report by James Walker. A health board has been fined £235,000 over a health and safety breach after a patient took his own life while in its care at the hospital. The 36-year-old man, a father of four, died 2 days after he was admitted to the South Ward at Dykebar Hospital in Paisley, Renfrewshire, on July the 22nd, 2020. An investigation by the Health and Safety Executive found that some of the fixtures and fittings on the ward were not of an anti-ligature design, prosecutor said. The Health and Safety Executive also found failures by NHS Greater Glasgow and Clyde to ensure that the existing ligature points at Dykebar Hospital were suitably and sufficiently risk assessed. NHS Greater Glasgow and Clyde last month pleaded guilty to a breach of health and safety regulations committed between January the 1st and March the 23rd, 2020. The health board was fined £235,000 with an additional victim surcharge of £17,625 when the case called for sentencing at Paisley Sheriff Court on Monday, the Crown Office and Procurator Fiscal Service said. Debbie Carroll, who leads on health and safety investigations for the Crown Office and Procurator Fiscal Service, said, NHS Greater Glasgow and Clyde had a duty to keep their patients safe. Had they implemented all reasonably practicable measures, they could have prevented him from taking his own life in the way he did. Their failure to ensure that ligature points within the hospital were suitably and sufficiently risk assessed, and that patients were not exposed to those ligature points, led to the death of a man in their care. This prosecution should remind duty holders that a failure to manage and implement effective measures can have fatal consequences, and they will be held accountable for this failure. Prosecutors said that following the death, remedial work was started, but the failings continued until March the 23rd, 2020. The Health Board managed the existing ligature risks by placing at-risk patients on enhanced observations by nursing staff. And that article was written by James Walker. From the National, Monday the 10th of July 2023, from the news section, Professor Eljamal surgery victim explains Hamza Yousaf interruption. Report by Laura Pollock. The woman who interrupted Hamza Yousaf at the SNP Independence Convention has said she did not intend to shout at the First Minister. Theresa Mallett suffered life-changing injuries after undergoing botched surgery for sciatica by Surgeon Professor Sam Eljamal. Mallett raised the issue during the First Minister's maiden speech to members as party leader at the SNP's convention on June 24th. Yousaf left the stage in Caird Hall to speak with Mallett, who was initially booed for her interruption by SNP delegates. The SNP chief then said, "Folks, let's not boo," and exited the stage to speak directly to the woman one-to-one in the sitting area, pausing proceedings for around 5 minutes. In her interview with The Guardian, the SNP member revealed she went to the convention with the hope of telling a journalist or SNP employee about her experience, but was enraged by Yousaf's speech. The 61-year-old is still unsure where her voice came from. Mallett recalled, "I was listening to Hamza Yousaf and he came out with something like, 'Every person in Scotland counts.' I felt enraged and I just started shouting at him. 11 years of trauma and pain, getting no answers, gaslit by doctors, that all came out. Where my voice came from, I don't know. I'm usually easygoing, but I was glad I got it out. The only thing I can remember clearly is him standing in front of me with his back to the cameras and saying a public inquiry is not off the table. Mallet is one of the hundreds of patients thought to have been harmed while the doctor was working at Nine Mills Hospital in Dundee. Yousaf has since visited Mallet at her home in Glenrothes. Mallet said she did not have enough seats for the First Minister's security and staff when they arrived, so had to use some garden deck chairs. She said the First Minister appeared to be listening to her concerns following the meeting. He also said he would look into her healthcare urgently. Mallet said, I reminded him that this just wasn't just about me, this is about 117 patients failed by NHS Tayside. I have made it clear, in no uncertain terms, that it's a public inquiry that I want, the patients need, and the public must see. A public inquiry would get people under oath to give evidence and find out who did what and when, and to make sure it doesn't happen again. Minutes of an NHS Tayside meeting, released by the Scottish Government under Freedom of Information, revealed the Health Board had been seen an escalating number of complaints involving Professor El Jamal. But these added that the doctor had been under significant pressure in recent years due to factors such as a deterioration in the quantity and quality of junior staff support, increased number of patients, and the Scottish Government's waiting times guarantee. Yousaf, a former health secretary, has agreed it was an incredibly serious issue where individuals have been left utterly traumatised. He told SNPs during a previous FMQs, we will work with these individuals, those victims, those survivors, in order to try to get them answers they absolutely deserve. Of course, a public inquiry is not ruled off the table, but let's look at how we can get them the answers they deserve as quickly as we possibly can. And that report was by Laura Pollock. From The National, Monday the 10th of July 2023, from the politics section, SNP MP John McNally to stand down at next general election. Article by Adam Robertson. SNP MP John McNally has announced he will stand down at the next general election. McNally has served as the MP for Falkirk since 2015, having first become an elected councillor in 2005 for the party. The MP told The National that his reasons for stepping down were straightforward. He explained, I'm very grateful to my local constituency association and SNP members for helping me win three general elections as well as being a local Falkirk councillor for 10 years. At present, I'm 72 years old and want to spend time with my wife Sandra, my own family, while still fit enough to do so. In a separate statement posted on Twitter, McNally said he had taken the decision after some soul searching. It comes after other high-profile figures within the SNP, including Ian Blackford and Marie Black, also announced they would be stepping down at the next general election. McNally said, it's not a decision I've taken lightly. It has been a privilege to speak on behalf of such a vibrant community. The people are not just constituents to me, but are friends, colleagues, neighbours and family. My time in politics is something I'd never imagined I'd experience, let alone for nearly a decade. 50 years ago, I ran a barbershop in Denny. I went on to work as a local councillor for the area, and then MP for Falkirk. The people I've met across this time come from every walk of life, and I've ensured I communicated their needs and wishes to those in power. It's a journey I'm grateful for. McNally becomes the 7th SNP MP to announce their intention to stand down at the next election. Previously, former SNP Westminster Group Leader Ian Blackford announced he would be standing down from his Ross, Skye and Lochaber seat. This was followed by long-standing Peter Grant, 62, the MP for Glenrothes and Westminster Group's Treasurer, who said he was unsure whether he would be able to cope with the physical and mental demands of the job due to his age. Elsewhere, Dunfermline and West Fife MP Douglas Chapman also said he would not be standing again, but insisted it was far from his retirement. Angela Crawley, MP for Lanark and Hamilton East since 2015, when the party gained a seat from Labour, said it had been a privilege to represent her constituents as she announced that she would be standing down. Senior MP and Treasury spokesperson Stuart Hosey announced he would not be seeking re-election at the end of June. Hosey has served almost 20 years in the Westminster and has been a member of the SNP for 4 decades. Last week, SNP Deputy Westminster leader Marie Black blasted the toxic, sexist and outdated culture in the House of Commons as she announced her intention to stand down on a podcast. And that article was by Adam Robertson. From the National, Monday the 10th of July 2023, from the comments section. Why would Rishi Sunak listen to the experts on drug decriminalisation? Column by Steph Payton. For anyone who understands the ideological bent of the contemporary Conservative Party, it was obvious that the Scottish Government's drug decriminalisation proposal was never going to be even considered. The failed war on drugs continues apace. Tough on crime, tough on drugs. An old copy of Now That's What I Call Conservatism in 79 that's gotten stuck in the cassette player. What else does the Conservative Party have left but to refuge in what it knows best? Still, the British state's derisive no in response to our government's considered proposals serves as another reminder of Scotland's place in the Union, an unfortunate byproduct of which being that Scotland needs always come second to the ideological posturing of whichever flavour of beast inhabits the halls of Westminster. And this is an ideological position, for sure. Drug decriminalisation is a proven method of harm reduction, with an increasing base of evidence as to its efficacy. It is a strategy that recognises the current path of criminalisation and punitive measures do not work, and have never worked, in helping with drug addiction. Rather, it raises barriers to accessing effective treatment. When we treat addiction as a health issue, rather than a criminal one, we can open the door to tackling the stigma of addiction and proving more effective, evidence-based routes to treatment, rather than the lifetime of diminished opportunities that a criminal record so generously provides. Countries like Portugal and Switzerland, who decriminalised the personal use of drugs in 2001 and 1991 respectively, have seen huge reductions in drug overdoses, HIV transmission, and drug-related crime since making the change. That went hand in hand with public health policies like providing safe injection rooms for folk with drug dependencies, who could cleanly and safely inject drugs in a supervised environment. This was the case in Glasgow, when Peter Crycant began operating a safe injection facility out of a minivan in the city, where drug deaths are rampant, only to be lifted by the cops while trying to save lives. At the moment, the law actively stands in the way of sensible measures like this one. But rather than entertain the idea that an evidence-based approach to drug use may be the most effective way to tackle Scotland's drug-related death crisis, the UK government is instead ideologically driven to keep ineffective laws in place that ruin and end lives. It's one of the many overt contradictions of conservatism that this government wants to push more children into STEM subjects at university over the arts and social sciences, while simultaneously displaying utter disregard as to the expertise of those same students upon graduating. It is the case that evidence-based and science-led policy on drugs plays no role in the government's advocacy for criminality. Just the same, tired, culture war-driven deference to conservative ideals over empathy. Back in 2009, the government's drug advisor David Nutt was pushed to resign after stating that drugs like cannabis, ecstasy and LSD were actually less harmful than legal drugs like alcohol and tobacco. It didn't matter that he was entirely correct. Had he transgressed the government's position that the arbitrary line that sets alcohol and tobacco on one side and everything else on the other was a good and just position? And, for that, then Home Secretary Alan Johnson asked for his resignation from the Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs. This happened less than a decade before Michael Gove's now infamous quip that Britain has had enough of experts, but this does not underline a fundamental characteristic of the UK government as an institution that is less interested in facts than it is playing to its base. And, while the Conservatives continue to indulge themselves in political games, the number of preventable deaths connected to drug use will continue to climb. Unfortunately, Labour aren't much better on this issue. Leader of the opposition, Keir Starmer, opposes decriminalisation and seems intent on capitalising on the same reactionary tendencies that the Conservatives are banking on. In mid-April of last year, the Labour Party bought political ads on social media, attacking the Lib Dems over their support for decriminalisation, blasting them for wanting to legalise drugs and soften punishments, an authoritarian rhetorical flourish that isn't even true. Decriminalisation and legislation are two completely different policies with different outcomes. For me, it's a hypocrisy that I find especially galling. By all accounts, drug use in Westminster is allegedly rife. One former politician previously told LBC that MPs have been known to snort cocaine off their desks, presumably just before trotting off to the chamber to vote on restricting the use of it for the rest of us. Like the Partygate before it, the UK government clearly sees these restrictions on drug use as something that applies to other people. Drugs have no intrinsic moral value attached to them. They're a good time at a party, a means of expanding our minds, and sometimes, too, they're the root of an addiction. While Scotland remains a part of the United Kingdom, trapped under successive reactionary and right-wing governments, we won't be able to treat addiction as a health issue it so clearly is. Instead, we'll continue to live under failed policy after failed policy from a political system that feels incapable of change, one that treats both its devolved government and its citizens like children needing to be kept in line. And that was a comment piece by Steph Payton. From The National, Monday the 10th of July, 2023, from the Culture section. Depeche Mode to bring the hit tour to Glasgow's Ovo Hydro. Report by Maxie MacArthur. Rock favourites Depeche Mode are to bring their hit tour to Glasgow, it has been announced. The band have extended their tour into 2024, with a stop-off at the West End's Ovo Hydro promised on January the 31st. With over 2 million tickets already sold, the 110-date Memento Mori tour is on track to be one of Depeche Mode's largest to date. Tickets for the Just Can't Get Enough Singers show will be available later this week, with pre-sale launching on Thursday and general box office following on Saturday. Depeche Mode have once again partnered with luxury Swiss watchmaker Hublot to supply the band's charity efforts. Around the tour, Hublot and Depeche Mode will be supporting Conservation Collective, a global network of foundations promoting grassroots environmental initiatives, with a special focus on projects aiming to tackle plastic pollution, waste management, and environmental cleanups. In addition, Depeche Mode will be working with Live Nation's Green Nation team to reduce the use of single-use plastics, improve recycling, and reduce food and other waste on tour and at the venues. Search online for tickets. And that article was by Maxie MacArthur.
This is from The National on Tuesday, the 11th of July, 2023, from the News section. Afghan students celebrate after graduating from Napier University. This article is written by Daniel Byron. A group of Afghan students have spoken of their pride having graduated from Edinburgh Napier following the Taliban insurgency. Tens of thousands of people fled Afghanistan when the country's government fell in 2021, when the Taliban took control and international troops withdrew. Amin ul Haq Majid, Bilal Rafi, Rafi Ullah Jabak Hale, Ahmad Rashad Halimi, Aldad Afghan, Idris Rasuli, Mujib Rahman Fazli, Ibrahim Anwari, and his brother Abdu Arahim Amnwari all picked up their degrees during the university's summer graduation ceremonies at Usher Hall. Since fleeing to Edinburgh, the Afghans have made the capital city their home, and between them, completed several different subjects, including business management and computing. Abdul Rahman Anwari already had an offer to attend Napier when the evacuation of Kabul took place 2 years ago. The 29-year-old said, "Suddenly everything changed. I informed Edinburgh Napier and they replied very quickly, offering me support such as hardship funds so that I could study. This was a turning point for me. I didn't even have £10 in my pocket when I arrived. It was a very difficult time, but thanks to the support from the university, we have made it through." My fellow Afghan students were in the same situation. "We have become friends by going on this journey together. We're very thankful to the university. It is impossible now, but one day I want to go back to Afghanistan with what I have learned." Bilal Rafi said, 2021 in Afghanistan was a very big problem. We lost everything when it all happened. But when we came here, Edinburgh Napier University helped us get started, and I'm very thankful for that. It was a very scary time. We didn't know anyone here, and our families weren't safe back home. Everything was at risk. Everything was unstable. On the first day when I came to the university, I didn't know anyone, except Amin. We didn't know anyone and we didn't have anything. But it gave us the motivation, the inspiration to complete our education and finally to complete our degree. You can feel it when you are here in a safe place and your family is at risk. It was very difficult mentally, especially for the first 4-6 months. I couldn't sleep at night. But later on, with the help of Edinburgh Napier University, especially the safeguarding team, we did it. That article was written by David Byron. This is from The National on Tuesday, the 11th of July, 2023, from the Politics section. Andy Murray among signatories of letter to Rishi Sunak on child health. This article is written by Anya Fox. Tennis star Sir Andy Murray is among a host of celebrities supporting a charity's demand to the Prime Minister for better early years support for children in the UK. Rishi Sunak has been urged to guarantee all babies and toddlers get the basic early help needed from maternity services to childhood education and care, no matter where they live in the UK. A letter to the PM has been coordinated by UNICEF and signed by dozens of other charities, experts in childhood development and high-profile names. They include actors Olivia Colman, who is UNICEF UK President, Ewan McGregor and Michael Sheen, singer Rita Ora and tennis champion Sir Andy. Other signatories include the NSPCC, Save the Children UK, and the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health. UNICEF said the baby and toddler guarantee should include accessible, quality and fully resourced maternity services, health visiting support, mental health support, SEND, Special Educational Needs and Disability Provision, infant feeding support and early childhood education and care. The charity has said that while the current policies that are in place represent good progress, they fall short in ensuring every baby and toddler can access the basic services and support they need. The letter to Sunak stated, "Families in Britain need your help now. Summer holidays are just around the corner, and instead of looking forward to fun-packed, carefree days, many families are faced with a worrying reality of not being able to put food on the table as they struggle to make ends meet." The latest government data shows that child poverty in the UK has increased by 300,000 in a year, bringing the latest estimate to a staggering 4.2 million. But behind those figures are real children and families. UNICEF said its poll last year of parents and children aged between 0 and 4 years old found two-thirds said the cost of living crisis had negatively impacted them, as they struggle to afford food, pay their bills, and cope with the increasing childcare costs. To compensate, many said they are having to cut back on buying books, toys, and other items for their children, the letter said. It added that the basic support services it is calling to be guaranteed can offer a vital lifeline to parents at this crucial time in their children's lives, especially when they're struggling financially. It added, across the country, children's centres and childcare settings have closed their doors. Health visiting appointments have been missed as staffing has reduced and caseloads increased. Mental health support for parents and children is hard to come by. Waiting lists are long and provision is patchy across the sector. The universal services that many new parents desperately need are not there for everyone. The charity said that more than 48,000 members of the public have signed its petition calling for the government to commit to a baby toddler guarantee. John Sparks, UNICEF UK's chief executive, said, "Every child deserves a bright future, but as families recover from the impacts of the pandemic and face unprecedented rises in the cost of living, this future is under threat. Basic services like health visits and mental health care provide essential support that households need during these turbulent times. They should be there for every baby and young child during their vital early years, but across the country, this isn't the case and urgent action is needed. Together with leading organisations, experts and families across the country, we call on the Prime Minister to deliver a baby and toddler guarantee to ensure all children get the support they need, no matter who you are or where you live." A government spokesperson said, "We are taking action across the range of public services to support families and boost children's life chances. We are rolling out the largest expansion in free childcare in history, worth £6,500 a year for an average working family, using 30 hours a week and delivering a cost of living support package worth an average of £3,300 per household. On top of this, we are providing a holiday and activities food programme, which is backed by £200 million per year to 2025, and expanding and transforming mental health services in England, so that 2 million more people will be able to get the mental health support they need." That article was written by Anya Fox. This is from The National on Tuesday, the 11th of July, 2023, from the news section. First bus to end night bus service across Greater Glasgow. This article is written by Maxine MacArthur. Night buses in Glasgow are to be scrapped at the end of the month, just 1 year after they were reintroduced. First Glasgow has confirmed it will withdraw its night bus services from July the 31st after a 12-month review monitoring passenger numbers confirmed it was regularly operating with as little as 14 passengers per hour. The change will impact 11 routes that operate across the city in the early hours of Saturday and Sunday mornings. The drivers who work late into the night to deliver these services will be redeployed into the daytime network to further support existing services across the city. Graham McFarlane, Commercial Director at First Bus Scotland, said, "We were delighted to be able to reintroduce our night bus network last June in an attempt to support the city's nighttime economy. Despite a wide variety of efforts by First Glasgow and partner organisations to increase the number of people using the night buses, it has not reached the level required to sustain these services beyond July. To do so, we would require the number of people using them each weekend to treble overnight, which is not realistic. We really wanted to give these services every chance to succeed, which is why we have absorbed the operating losses for the last 12 months. It has become clear, however, given the change in behaviour and times people are going out in the city at the weekend, there is not enough appetite in Glasgow for the night bus services to successfully operate into the early hours. First Glasgow reintroduced its night bus services in June 2022 to help boost the nighttime economy in the city as COVID-19 restrictions were lifted. Despite significant efforts from First Glasgow to promote the services, including offering free tickets in December last year, passenger numbers remained between 30% and 35%. The buses covered travel from the city centre across Glasgow and the surrounding areas, including Clydebank, Paisley, Newton Mearns, East Kilbride, Hamilton, Motherwell and Wishaw. That article was written by Maxine MacArthur. This is from The National on Tuesday, the 11th of July, 2023, from the politics section. Mari Black, I have bomb protection and panic alarms at home. This article is written by James Walker. Mari Black has revealed that the threat of being an MP led her to install bomb protection and panic alarms in her home. It comes after the SNP deputy Westminster leader announced last week she would be standing down at the next general election. In her first interview since the announcement, she told Lorraine Kelly on STV that being an MP led to safety concerns from her family. She said, "I see it when my parents come around to visit. They see the panic alarms in the house, they see the bomb bag over the letterbox, and it's just a very stark reminder their daughter is a target for things." In her resignation statement, Black said she had taken the decision to quit Parliament due to the outdated, sexist and toxic working environment. The 28-year-old went into more detail with Kelly, adding that violence and bullying were also an issue. She said, "I've seen people crying. I've seen people in tears. I've seen folk getting manhandled and dragged into lobbies. I've seen punch-ups. I've seen all sorts. The thing that's upsetting most is that within Westminster, nobody actively condones it, but equally, most people accept that's just the nature of Parliament. And I think, why? If this was any other workplace, you'd be huckled out. The police would be talking to you." Black also called the voting system in Westminster archaic. She said, "Tomorrow we've got something like 15 votes, which is absolutely fine, but because of the archaic voting system, where you walk through the lobbies and corridors, it adds up to about 4 hours where we're doing nothing but walking through corridors. You're queued up, everyone's jam-packed into these lobbies. They put these doors at 45-degree angles and you go through one at a time." She went on, "I've always said that there's a place for tradition, but when tradition gets in the way of functionality, then it's a problem." SNP MP John Nicholson agreed with her, tweeting, "This is spot on from Mari Black. The voting system at Westminster is absurd, a complete silly waste of time." A House of Commons spokesperson said, "Bullying, harassment and sexual misconduct have absolutely no place in Parliament and we take any complaint of unacceptable behaviour extremely seriously. We remain committed to ensuring that lasting cultural change can be achieved here and that our behaviour code makes clear the standards of behaviour expected of everyone in Parliament, whether MPs, MP staff, members of the House of Lords or visitors. The Behaviour Code is supported by the Independent Complaints and Grievances Scheme, ICGS. That article was written by James Walker.
The National News on Wednesday, the 12th of July. Call to quadruple the council tax rate for second homes. An article written by Judith Duffy. Scotland should follow the lead of Wales by introducing a council tax premium 4 times the normal rate on second and empty homes to help tackle the housing crisis, a leading trade union body has argued. The Scottish Trades Union Congress, or STUC, said the radical measure could generate vital extra resources for local authorities north of the border, and an even higher rate should also be considered. The call to allow councils to charge a 300% premium on the normal council tax rate has been made in a response to a Scottish Government consultation on whether owners of second homes or empty properties should pay more. The proposal would mean instead of paying a normal rate of £1,000, for example, the owners of a second home could face a bill as high as £4,000. In the submission, the union stated, councils in Wales can levy a premium of up to 300%, and the legislation in Scotland should be equivalent to this level or higher. Meanwhile, in England, you can be charged up to four times your normal council tax bill if your home has been empty for 10 years or more. STUC General Secretary Ros Foyer said, Scotland is facing a simultaneous housing crisis, a public sector funding crisis, and a cost of living crisis, putting an unbearable strain on working people. Second homes and short-term lets can have significantly negative impacts on communities, exacerbating these crises as well as undermining the local economy. We cannot ever hope to solve the chronic lack of housing, with the unforgivable levels of homelessness throughout the country, if the Scottish Government continues down this path of reinforcing rentierism. A premium on council tax for homes that are not in use, second homes and short-term lets would provide vital extra resources for local authorities, helping incentivise homes into use, raise revenue and bring down rents in the long term. There is wealth in Scotland. It's high time it was shared. Currently, councils in Scotland have the option to charge double the normal rate of council tax if a property has been unoccupied for more than 12 months. The Scottish Government consultation, which opened in April, is seeking views on whether councils should also charge this rate on second homes from April next year. And the option to grant further powers to charge more than double the rate on both empty and second homes in future years is also being considered. Announcing the consultation, First Minister Hamza Yousaf said, We want everyone in Scotland to have an affordable home that meets their needs, and this work to improve the availability of sustainable long-term housing opportunities is a core part of that. By recognising the important role councils have in considering local needs, these proposals aim to strike a balance between good housing supply and helping communities to thrive and benefit from tourism. In Wales, local authorities were given powers to charge a council tax premium of up to 300% on second homes and empty lets in April. An article written by Judith Duffy. The National News on Wednesday, the 12th of July. Call to plan ahead for big cycling event. An article written by Gregor Young. People in Glasgow are being encouraged to get ready and plan ahead as anticipation builds for the 2023 UCI Cycling World Championships. The event will take place across the city and Scotland in just over 3 weeks' time. The Cycling World Championships will be the single biggest cycling event in history, with Glasgow hosting 8 of the 13 championships at 5 of its world-class venues, alongside several important operational and event management hubs. On road race days, the city is planning for attendances of up to 45,000 people along the routes and up to 5,000 people visiting the official fan zone in George Square. Venues will also be buzzing with activity as competition takes place across the city centre every day of the championships. As a result, Glasgow will be busier than usual in the lead-up to and during the event, with businesses, residents and commuters being reminded to plan ahead and familiarise themselves with the way in which their usual journeys around the city may be impacted. The event's road race events will have an impact on travel and transport around Glasgow city centre and the West End in particular, on the days before and during competition. Closures and restrictions are needed to build the cycling road race courses and facilitate the safe delivery of the event for participants, spectators and businesses. All route and road closure maps are available on the Get Ready Glasgow website and more than 45,000 letters have been distributed to businesses and residents on or near to the affected routes to inform them of the events and impacts. Councillor Susan Aitken, leader of Glasgow City Council, said, "Glasgow will once again be on the world stage in under a month's time as we gear up to host the 2023 UCI Cycling World Championships. Preparations are well underway to keep Glasgow moving over the course of the cycling worlds, but an event of this size will inevitably impact on how the city operates on certain days, and some closures and restrictions will be essential." She added, "We want to ensure businesses and residents have all the information they need to go about their daily lives when the city is busier than usual. If you're travelling in the city on the affected days, we would urge you to check any changes to your route and plan your journey in advance. For all the latest information on closures and restrictions in Glasgow related to the event in August, visit www.getreadyglasgow.com. An article written by Gregor Young. The National News on Wednesday, the 12th of July. Royal Mail strikes to end as union votes overwhelmingly for a pay deal. An article written by Steph Braun. Royal Mail workers have voted overwhelmingly to accept a deal to end a long-running dispute over pay, jobs and conditions. Members of the Communication Workers Union, or CWU, backed the agreement by 75%. The union said the vote signals the end of the dispute, which saw more than 115,000 workers take 18 days of strike action in the final quarter of last year. CWU General Secretary Dave Ward said, "This has been the most challenging period in both the history of the union and the company, and I want to thank every single member that has voted in this ballot. Our members will know it doesn't end with today's result. We all know what's going on in workplaces across the UK, and we're going to deal with it. Many workers simply don't trust Royal Mail Group because of the company's lack of integrity and the way they're being treated. Some wanted more from an agreement. Others find the prospect of changes such as later finishes unpalatable. Our job in the coming weeks and months is to make sure their voices continue to be heard." Far from being an endorsement of the actions of Royal Mail Group, this result will be the start of the union reconnecting in every workplace. A company spokesperson said, "The agreement provides Royal Mail a platform for the next phase of stabilising the business while continuing to drive efficiencies and change. The operational changes in the agreement are designed to be good for customers, increasing our ability to improve services and quality, good for employees, retaining job security and giving people a pay rise, good for the environment, reducing the company's reliance on domestic air, further reducing carbon emissions, and good for shareholders, supporting the long-term sustainability of the business." The three-year pay deal agreed provides certainty for employees and ensures Royal Mail remains the industry leader on pay, terms and conditions. An article written by Steph Braun. The National News on Wednesday, the 12th of July. Staff shortages leaves quarriers in crisis. An article written by Lucy Garcia. A leading Scottish care provider has said it's in crisis amid staff shortages and warned that things are only going to get worse unless something changes. Andrew Williamson, Deputy Chief Executive of social care provider Quarriers, said it faces staff shortages every day and that people leaving the sector is part of the problem. Yesterday, the Coalition of Care and Support Providers in Scotland revealed that an average of 52% of staff who moved jobs last year left the social care industry. It also found that three-quarters of organisations reported high staff turnover between 2021 and 2022. Mr. Williamson said, "We're now at a point where every day we face staff shortages. We've got staff working extra hours and we're having to use expensive agency staff to cover shifts. We've got a duty of care to ensure anyone in our care is looked after, but there's not a day that goes by where we're not moving staff around and using agency workers. It's hitting us badly." Quarriers employs upwards of 1,700 staff. Mr. Williamson said agency staff cost anywhere between 50% and 70% more than their own staff, with weekend and holiday premiums ramping the costs up further. He explained that many employees are leaving to enter into other industries, such as retail and hospitality. Mr. Williamson said, part of the problem is that there's a lot of people leaving the sector generally, as other sectors are becoming more lucrative from a financial point of view. Our staff have big responsibilities, people rely on our workers, and workers are realising that if they go to hospitality or retail, there's less responsibility and salaries are higher. He added that existing staff are having to work longer hours and extra shifts to make up for the shortfall, and that as many experienced care workers leave, newer care industry workers are under pressure to meet demands. Mr. Williamson said, "It's not just us. Every provider I talk to is facing the same problem right now. One of the biggest problems we have is that the Scottish Government has made a commitment to pay all staff a minimum of £10.90 an hour. The money has been made available, but the length of time between them making it available and it actually reaching care companies takes a long time. We've still not received that money yet. It puts all organisations under huge financial stress. We're in crisis at the moment, and without something changing, it's only going to get worse." A Scottish Government spokesperson said, "We know the sector faces challenges, and we're committed to working with all partners to improve social care services. We remain committed to delivering a national care service to provide high-quality care across the country and make sure staff feel valued. We're looking at how we can plan for, attract, train, employ and nurture the workforce, working with COSLA on consistency of improved pay and conditions, improving access to training and development, and ensuring a career in social care is attractive and rewarding. We're also continuing to work towards our commitment to increase spend in social care by 25% by the end of this Parliament, an increase of over £840 million. An article written by Lucy Garcia. The National World News on Wednesday, the 12th of July. Victims are buried 28 years on from the Srebrenica anniversary. An article written by Jane McLeod. Thousands of people from Bosnia and abroad gathered in Srebrenica for the annual commemoration of the 1995 massacre and to bury victims unearthed from mass graves and only recently identified through DNA analysis. 28 years after they were murdered in Europe's only acknowledged genocide since the Holocaust, 27 men and 3 teenage boys were laid to rest at a vast cemetery just outside Srebrenica, joining more than 6,600 massacre victims already reburied there. Relatives of the victims can bury only partial remains of their loved ones, as they are typically found scattered over several different mass graves, sometimes miles apart. Such was the case for Mirza Mirjic, who buried her father yesterday. Only a very few bones of his were retrieved, because he had been found near the Drina River, she said while huddling next to a coffin shrouded in green burial cloth. Maybe the river washed him away. Selma Ramic reburied a handful of bones of her father's several years ago, but continues returning to the town for the anniversary to honour others who shared his fate. "One photo is the only thing I have left of my father, but I have love for him in my heart," she said, adding, "He still lives in us. He will live on as long as we're alive." The Srebrenica killings were the bloody crescendo of Bosnia's 1992 to 1995 war, which came after the breakup of Yugoslavia unleashed nationalist passions and territorial ambitions that set Bosnian Serbs against the country's two other main ethnic populations, Croats and Bosniaks. On July the 11th, 1995, Bosnian Serbs overran a UN-protected safe haven in Srebrenica. They separated at least 8,000 Muslim Bosniak men and boys from their wives, mothers and sisters, chased them through woods around the town and slaughtered them. The perpetrators then ploughed their victims' bodies into hastily made mass graves, which they later dug up with bulldozers, scattering the remains among other burial sites to hide the evidence of their war crimes. The Bosnian Serb wartime political leader Radovan Karadzic and his military commander Ratko Mladic were both convicted of genocide in Srebrenica by a special UN war crimes tribunal in The Hague. In all, the tribunal and courts in the Balkans have sentenced close to 50 Bosnian Serb wartime officials to more than 700 years in prison for the Srebrenica killings. However, most Serbian and Bosnian Serb officials still celebrate Mr. Karadzic and Mr. Mladic as national heroes and continue to downplay or even deny the Srebrenica killings. An article written by Jane McLeod.
From The National, Thursday the 13th of July 2023, from the news section. BBC Scotland issues third correction over reporting in a month, by Xander Eliards. BBC Scotland has issued its third correction linked to reporting on the SNP and Scottish Government in a month. On Wednesday, the corporation published an apology after mistakes across its reporting on an issue related to the use of herbicide on Scottish farms. The SNP Green Government had opted to follow expert advice from the UK Government's Health and Safety Executive and not allow the use of Asolox control bracken. Asolox, a brand name of the chemical herbicide Asolam, was therefore banned for use in Scotland and Wales for the first time. It is also banned by the EU. However, England chose to go ahead and authorise the use of the chemical against health and safety executive advice. The BBC reported that the Scottish Government had said the risk to the environment and human health do not outweigh the potential benefits. In fact, this was the opposite of what both the experts and the Scottish ministers were saying. In a correction issued on Wednesday but relating to June the 22nd, the BBC said the mistake had occurred across BBC Scotland news outlets. The corporation wrote, "In reporting that the Scottish Government had decided that a herbicide previously used to control bracken on farms in Scotland will not be authorised for use this season, we stated that this was because the risks don't outweigh the benefits. In fact, the decision was made because the risks do outweigh the benefits. We apologise for the error." Despite the expert advice, the Tories and UK government had attempted to pressure the Scottish government into allowing the use of Asolox on farms. Alistair Jack, the Scottish Secretary, claimed that banning the chemical was absolutely the wrong decision. Jack said it had been approved for use in England, adding, "Bracken spreads across upland land for upland sheep farmers, and it's a serious problem. As it goes, it creates a biodiversity desert, but it also harbours ticks, and ticks are not only bad for animals, but ticks are also bad for humans and the potential of Lyme disease, which is a terrible disease, and one that when you've got it, you can't get rid of it. So I think it is the wrong decision." Rural Affairs Secretary Marie Goujon said that the SNP government was acutely aware of the risks associated with uncontrolled bracken and did not take this decision lightly, but warned the herbicide poses risk to human, animal and environmental health. The BBC's correction comes after it issued two others related to the SNP and Scottish Government in the space of a month. On June the 12th, the corporation accepted that it had reported on Margaret Ferrier, the MP facing a recall petition in Rutherglen and Hamilton West, without making clear that she no longer represented the SNP. And, later in June, it apologised after accusing Hamza Yousaf of U-turning on an NSNP manifesto commitment about free school meals when he had not. The UK-wide BBC also had to issue a correction of its coronation coverage after falsely reporting that all British coronations since 1066 had taken place at Westminster. And that was an article by Xander Eliards. From The National, Thursday the 13th of July 2023, news. The Sun inflicted terror on Hugh Edwards with no evidence of crime. Article by Xander Eliards. A former editor of The Sun newspaper has said that the outlet inflicted terror on BBC's Hugh Edwards despite no evidence of any criminal offence. David Yelland, who edited The Sun from 1998 to early 2003, said the newspaper now faced a crisis. "I wish I'd signed D. Hugh Edwards well," he wrote on Twitter. The Sun inflicted terror on Hugh despite no evidence of any criminal offence. "This is no longer a BBC crisis, it is a crisis for the paper. Hugh's privacy must now be respected. Social media also needs speedy reform." John Sopel, the co-presenter of the Newsagents podcast, who was formerly a top political correspondent at the BBC, said that the case showed there were a number of people in the tabloid press and, dare I say it, in BBC News, who need to give themselves a good hard look in the mirror. After his remarks on Good Morning Britain, Sopel added online, "I didn't say any of this lightly, but have been struck by how many of my former BBC colleagues, some very senior, have been in touch to express their anger and dismay at their own coverage of this." The comments from Yelland and Sopel come after Edwards was named as a BBC star at the centre of the scandal by his wife, Vicky Flynd. Naming the 61-year-old as the BBC presenter facing allegations over payments for sexually explicit images, Flynd said the father of five is suffering from serious mental health issues and is now receiving treatment in hospital. Edwards, one of the BBC's most recognisable newsreaders, has been outspoken about his struggles with depression over the decades, saying that he has been at times left in bedridden. While the police have concluded an investigation and said no criminality was established, the BBC are continuing with fact-finding investigations. It comes after BBC Newsnight reported new claims from one current and one former BBC worker, who said they had received inappropriate messages from Edwards, some late at night and signed off with kisses. Both said there was a reluctance amongst junior staff to complain to managers about the conduct of high-profile colleagues in case it adversely affected their careers, the programme alleged. Following Edwards' family statement, BBC Director-General Tim Davies said, in a note to staff, "It is important that the work on the internal investigation continues," adding, "I want to be clear that in doing so we will follow due process." Davey also stressed that the corporation's immediate concern is our duty of care to all involved. The Sun said it had no plans to publish further allegations and will cooperate with the BBC's internal investigation process. The paper has also insisted that it had not alleged criminality in its early reporting of the case, despite claiming that a BBC star had paid a young person more than £35,000 since they were 17 in return for sordid images. The Sun claimed other media had misrepresented its story and led the police to get involved, saying in a statement, "We must also re-emphasise that The Sun at no point in our original story alleged criminality, and also took the decision neither to name Mr Edwards nor the young person involved in the allegations." Edwards is the BBC's highest paid newsreader, with a pay bracket of £435,000 to £4,399,999. Putting him fourth on the top 10 list, the corporation's annual report revealed on Tuesday. The presenter was last seen on BBC One's News at 10 on July the 5th, when he co-presented a special edition live from Edinburgh as the King was honoured in the Scottish capital. Sources have made it clear to PA that Edwards has not resigned from the BBC. The statement from his wife, a TV producer who has worked on BBC's This Week in Politics show, and Robert Peston's ITV programme, Peston, to the Press Association said, "Hugh is suffering from serious mental health issues. As is well documented, he has been treated for severe depression in recent years. The events of the last few days have greatly worsened matters. He has suffered another serious episode and is now receiving inpatient hospital care where he will stay for the foreseeable future." She said that once a presenter, who has worked for the BBC for 4 decades, is well enough, he intends to respond to the stories that have been published, and added that her husband was first told there were allegations being made against him last Thursday. In an article by Xander Eliards. From The National, Thursday the 13th of July 2023, from the comment section, "Labour's hopeless vision is a slap in the face to those in need," by Caitlin Logan. Last weekend, Labour Shadow Health Secretary Wes Streeting set out in The Guardian his party's intention not to make promises that it cannot keep, arguing that the only thing worse than no hope is false hope. Labour for no hope is quite the campaign slogan, but it's certainly an accurate one if recent statements from the party leadership are anything to go by. No additional spending in public services. No time for young people standing up for the protection of our planet. And no plans to scrap the two-child limit, despite this being one of the single biggest drivers of the rise in child poverty under the Conservative government. What the party has promised is that it will be focused on growing the economy. Just last week, Labour leader Keir Starmer revealed a clear view on competing priorities when he told a climate protester, "We're on the side of economic growth." In Streeting's words, this is the only way we are going to be able to give public services the investment they need. This sounds a lot like telling people to keep waiting for any sort of improvement to their lives to trickle down to them while they continue to watch the rich get richer. For too many people in Britain today, waiting is something they can ill afford. Often politicians talk about hard choices. Turning off the heating in the middle of winter and watching your child shiver from the cold just so that you can keep them fed is a hard choice. Telling your kids you're on a diet so they don't wonder why you're skipping meals is a hard choice. Investing in lifting families out of poverty, today, not at some undetermined point in the future, should never be a difficult choice to make. This is the reality of life under the Conservative government for many, and one of the hardest hit groups have been families with three or more children. Analysis from the End Child Poverty Coalition finds that 42% of children in these families are in poverty, and this is projected to rise to over 50% by 2026-27, unless urgent action is taken. With the new data on the two-child limit on the universal credit published today by the Department of Work and Pensions, campaigners estimate that 250,000 children would be lifted out of poverty if the policy were scrapped, while the depth of poverty would be lessened for a further 850,000 children. Unsurprisingly, data at the constituency level also reveals that areas where higher proportions of children are impacted by the policy are, in many cases, the same areas with higher rates of child poverty. This is a policy which was introduced in 2017 by the Tories, with the argument that families receiving benefit should face the same financial choices about having children as those supporting themselves solely through work, a position which entirely fails to recognise the concept of unforeseen changes in circumstances. It's also a policy which has become synonymous with its associated rape clause, an also generous exemption which means that benefits can be paid for additional children who are born as a result of rape or coercion. Last year, 1,830 mothers declared that they'd been coerced or raped in order to access the support for their children. And, undoubtedly, there will be many more who are left struggling without it because they did not want to be re-traumatised or put themselves at risk by disclosing this. This represents the absolute worst of Conservative politics and the heartbreaking consequences that it has had for families and vulnerable people over their time in government. So, if reversing it is indeed not Labour Party policy, as Starmer said during a recent Q&A, then Streeting is right. The outlook is pretty damn hopeless. It is undeniable that false hope will not put food on the table, nor will it keep children warm, happy and healthy. But, at a time when the world looks so very bleak, telling people that no hope is preferable and even worth voting for feels like a slap in the face. Thankfully, not everyone in Labour shares the same perspective on what their party should prioritise in government. Backbench Labour MP Kim Johnson led a debate in Parliament on Tuesday on the two-child limit and child poverty and has said that tackling child poverty has to be a cornerstone of her party's politics. Speaking in the debate, Labour MP Mick Whiteley said, "Our party should make an explicit commitment to scrap the two-child limit in the first days of the next Labour government." In fact, Starmer's own comments came in response to a question about the fact that his work and pension spokesperson, Jonathan Ashworth, had described the policy as heinous in the days prior. The question is, will these voices be listened to when the time comes to demonstrate what Labour values look like in action in 2024? If we look back at the record of the last Labour government, for all its flaws, and there were many, child poverty was something it took seriously. One of the core pledges of Tony Blair's government was to lift 1 million children out of poverty. It took longer than promised, but there were, in fact, more than 1 million fewer children living in poverty before housing costs, which is the measure used by the UK government, by 2010-11, than when the Labour Party took power in 1997. One of the final actions of the Labour government was to introduce the Child Poverty Act of 2010, which imposed a legal duty on the government to meet child poverty targets, much as we now have in Scotland. And perhaps the most telling and on-brand action taken by the Tories over the last 13 years of power, the Child Poverty Act was repealed in 2016. In one fell swoop, multiple welfare reforms were introduced, which have unravelled the progress made under Labour. I say all of this to make it very clear that I am not talking about some idealistic vision of the Labour Party that has never existed. There is nothing radical about saying the social security system should do exactly what it did up until April 2017 and support all children. If the goalposts over what is right and what is wrong can shift so easily because one very right-wing party has gotten away with it, why even bother standing as the opposition at all? Charities like Child Poverty Action Group have now begun making calls within Scotland for the devolved government to use its own social security powers to mitigate against the two-child limit. It's no wonder. Despite the increasing likelihood that we'll have a Labour government at Westminster this time next year, the prospect of real change to some of the worst features of the status quo is dwindling by the minute. For the sake of the people across the UK, who are suffering immeasurably under cruel policies like the two-child limit, we need to keep up the pressure and appeal to those in Labour who understand that ending child poverty is something worth standing for, whatever the costs. Meanwhile, just don't hold it against those of us in Scotland if we are looking to the nearest exit in search of hope. And that was a comment piece by Caitlin Logan.
That concludes this week's edition of the National Podcast. Please remember to subscribe to our channels at Hume Review and tell your friends about our service.